Senate Judiciary Committee is having a hearing Wednesday, February 23rd, 1983, 5 p.m. in Hearing Room A.
Come to order. First bill we're going to hear today is Senate Bill 149. Terry, do you know how to pronounce that? Starts
Hippenham.
Out. Hippenham. Hippenhamel?
Yes.
And how do you, you want to come on up?
Yes.
Do you have any written testimony?
Yes, I do. And it's with the clerk.
That is, you have that, Dan.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Terry Hippenhammer. I'm representing the Department of Higher Education, where I'm the coordinator of information system services. My primary responsibility is for planning of administrative data processing. The purpose of my testimony is to support the enactment of a bill for computer crime.
Senate Bill 149.
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
We are living during a period of history which has seen an incredible explosion of technological advances. During the past 35 years, computers have radically changed how Oregon does business. During this period, technology has brought new efficiencies to business, and it has allowed for a tremendous capability for storing and retrieving data. It can be said that during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, a certain aura about computers and data processing created a new workforce within our society of computer specialists. An entirely new language evolved and was understood only by those in the profession. During this time, the user community relinquished its control of its files and reporting to the computer specialists. While this caused some consternation among the users and certainly created, in some cases, hostility towards the computer specialists, at the same time, there was a certain security within the user community knowing that they could sit on the sidelines and watch this computer revolution. The point I wish to make this evening is that true revolution cannot occur until the idea reaches the populace. And that is exactly what is happening in computing today. Perhaps you saw the article in the recent edition of National Geographic on the microprocessor chip. This recent phenomenon has allowed the creation of what is now known as the microcomputer. This computer has become available at such low cost and with such high computing capability that the executive can now have on his or her desk the computing power of a $1 million computer for the price of thousands. Industry is struggling with how to integrate microcomputers into their business process. During 1983, some 10,000 Merrill Lynch account executives will get IBM personal computers loaded with custom financial software and supplied with satellite communication capability as part of a major office automation program. Ford Motor Company recently chose the Victor 9000 as a standard microcomputer for its professional end users. Ford expects to install 15,000 microcomputers during the next 3 years, excuse me, that's 1,500, for the next 3 years for use by their executives. AT&T is currently taking volume bids from a number of personal computer manufacturers. The microcomputers, which may eventually total more than 15,000, according to an AT&T official, will be used by executives and other office workers at AT&T's facilities. We in higher education are scrambling to keep up with this technological change. There's much talk across the country of how best to use microcomputers in instruction. Some institutions have gone as far as requiring all students to own a microcomputer. Carnegie Mellon and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute on the East Coast have announced agreements with microcomputer vendors to provide micros to students, allowing for the computer to be paid off over a 3 or 4 year period. Dartmouth is considering making micros available to all students as part of their standard tuition and fees. In 1967, college students bought slide rules at a cost of $55. Counting for inflation, that would be $150 today. I'm sure that many of you have seen in recent newspaper ads Texas Instruments home computer being available for $149. In all likelihood, 1983 will be the year of the home computer. During 1982, companies such as Radio Shack, Texas Instruments, and Commodore sold home computers as if they were going out of style. These computers have the full functionality of more expensive microcomputers. They have the same capability to act as computer terminals and gain access to large IBM and other manufacturer computers. So the day of a computer in every home is fast upon us. In late 1982, Commodore announced the Commodore 64 computer at the retail price of $595. This computer had 64,000 bytes of memory storage. This is greater memory capability than the computers of the 1960s. But to underline for you the explosion that is occurring, in this week's MIS Week newspaper, Commodore announced they will be offering a new 128,000 byte microcomputer. This micro will retail for $795. When asked if this new announcement wouldn't kill their Commodore 64 product line, the company spokesman said, "I'm not worried that lower prices or new features on my new products will kill my old ones. Better for me to be my own competitor than for someone else to be the competitor." It seems that with each new release of computing technology, the price decreases and the performance increases. Now, I've been talking with you all this time and have not yet given specific testimony regarding the proposed bill. The picture I've wanted to paint for you is one of potential abuse. Yes, there are cases of white-collar computer crime. There are cases of student computer crime. But in coming to you today, frankly, I didn't think I'd be able to impress you with a list of recent cases of computer crime, since the list would not be that long. However, my concern is with the potential for such crime. Every indicator predicts the 1980s to be a decade of overwhelming technological change, probably exceeding in impact all the years preceding them. In all likelihood, in the next very few years, a computer in every home will become a reality. In November, a friend of mine and I both purchased Texas Instruments 99 4A computers for our homes. In just 3 short months, the leisure time spent at my house has changed dramatically for the 6 of us. Our use of educational, game, and financial packages have brought us into a sense of family adventure. As part of my friend's TI computer, he bought a modem and necessary equipment to allow him access to national networks. He is now able to access a network called The Source, which provides him with a tremendous array of databases. This includes Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal, airline reservations, computer searching for catalog purchases, Time weather news, and the list goes on and on. For $89, he was able to acquire the modem and the initiation fee to The Source. It's because of these low costs associated with microcomputers and the corresponding use at home that I believe we in the state of Oregon should clearly define for our citizens those areas of computing that are clearly no-nos, if you will. The potential for crime as computers become integral parts of our homes will increase significantly. Whether or not our colleges and universities here in Oregon require students to purchase their own microcomputers, we already see our students by the hundreds acquiring these inexpensive home computers to help them with their homework assignments in chemistry and math, computer science, and even within the social sciences. Similar bills have been adopted in a number of states, including Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Rhode Island, Michigan, and New Mexico. In conclusion, I would encourage you to consider action on this proposed legislation. Those who may find it intellectually stimulating to attempt breaking security to access confidential files should have clear legal deterrent for such activity.
Thank you very much. We've got several bills here today, and it's just by coincidence, this first bill, only two people have signed up, and the other bills, many have. So I would like to move through this bill rather quickly, but if there are questions, that's a fascinating exposition you've given us, but I really don't want to get into learning all about it at the committee.
And you're not interested in running out and buying stock?
Are there any questions for the committee after my that?
A question for counsel, and I don't mean to really spring this on you without by your leave, but we're not relying upon the common law here anymore. We've got essentially codified common law like fraud and wrongful appropriation. Why
theft?
Why don't those remedies provide us a statutory criminal avenue against the offender, I wonder.
Jim Mattis, do you want to come on up? While this doesn't seem to be a question for the witness, go ahead, counsel.
Well, yeah, maybe Mr. Matt. I know this issue, this is a bill that's identical to one that was before this committee 2 years ago, and that was an issue that was discussed at length, I believe, and I don't...
I remember a couple years ago we had the people who owned RVs coming to us. No, CBs. I'm sorry. CB radio owners, and they were having them stolen out of their trucks, and so they wanted a new offense carved out of theft of CB radios. But we do have some generic crimes that handle that.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I am Jim Mattis with the Attorney General's Office. If I can answer the Senator Brown's question as most directly as I can, there are statutory provisions, and in my testimony that I believe you do have a copy of on page 4, you will see a listing of the statutes that we can identify where, under appropriate circumstances, you could try to shoehorn what we have chose to call in Senate Bill 149, computer fraud and abuse under the amendments that I would like to bring for you. But it is not always possible to do that. I have listed out for you on page 3, for example, a very recent case out of the state of New York, People versus Wegg, in which there was a charge of theft of services brought against an individual whose employer was a city board of education. And that statute, as my testimony lays out, is the same statute that our criminal theft of services statute was based on, so says the commentary to the criminal code at least, uses very similar terminology, and it thrusts you in the direction of concluding that it needs to be in a commercial setting before you could apply the concept of having thieved because of the use of the term business. So in this instance, and on page 5, I have given the court's conclusion in which it notes that we have had a number of states now, 11 specifically, that have passed computer crime legislation that are fairly straightforward in terms of making it at least a misdemeanor to access a computer knowingly and without authorization. And then if you go on to defraud and do other sorts of things, as 149 would also suggest, it could be a felony. And he concludes that his court doesn't have the capacity to rewrite the statute. If the legislature is concerned enough with it, it needs to go back and write a statute addressing specifically the issue. The shoehorn sort of issue problem is the reason the Department of Justice brings the bill to you. The evidentiary issues, the prosecuting issues, the fact that, as Mr. Hippenhammer reveals, the widespread availability of computers is a revolution. The ability to access somebody else's computer is there for the creative person, and it probably always will be. Given the intangibility of the product in many instances, given the ability to access a security system in the computer, copy it, be able to access the state's or anybody else's, which is the case described in Appendix B, and the ease with which that can be done, at least makes us believe that it's time that we had a statute that was more straightforward and addressed specifically to computers.
Sure.
Senator Gardner.
Sorry, I came in late because I was delayed by a prior committee, but did you, in your prior testimony, point out any specific prosecution problems you have had in the state of Oregon with respect to computer fraud, that kind of thing?
No. Mr. Hippenhammer is at the University of Oregon, and so probably ought to be addressed more to me, and I did not give that sort of testimony. To the extent I've given any, it was just now in response to Senator Brown's question. I do not have any specific testimony to bring to you that relates specifically to computer fraud in the state of Oregon. All I can bring to you are the sorts of things that the literature is becoming very extensive with, saying that there is crime out there. It has its own terminology now. There's such things as called the salami technique, where you can take 10 cents off of, you know, everybody's account in a particular bank and put it in your own, and over a period of time, because of the speed and the extensive use of computers, you can bankroll that into a pretty good size account. People don't tend to look at 10 cents as being anything to be concerned with. The bank will say it's an inconvenience to fuss with it, or the owner will say it's my error. I mean, there's all sorts of crimes that have been documented. I cannot bring you any specifically for Oregon.
One of the problems, frankly, the crime is committed here simply by unauthorized access, isn't it? That completes the crime.
Knowing unauthorized access, that is correct.
Without necessarily any, let's say, you know, the ones you read about are where people arrange to have money transferred to their account, steal money, essentially, from someone else's account or from the bank's funds.
That
would not be required. No damage would be required. No. Act of access alone would be the crime.
Knowing access alone, unauthorized access, would be the misdemeanor offense. If you went on and defraud, it would be the felony offense under this bill.
How about, do you have authorized access when you, suppose you do, when you have these things that cable television companies now have, where you can tie into their computer using your push-button telephone into their computer network? I suppose that would be authorized access.
My understanding is it is, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The types of unauthorized access, well, one type is the example that is depicted in the literature that I've given to you in Appendix A, which is a state employee in the state of Indiana who had a computer, but who was only supposed to be, you know, getting data. But he made over 3,700 unauthorized accesses into the state's central computer, and could do all sorts of things, including destroy records
and what have you.
Yeah, did those merge? Did those merge? Are those separate crimes, separate offenses under this bill?
These would be. The misdemeanor is a lesser included offense of the felony offense.
Well, would those be all separate offenses, those 7,000 acts of access?
I would assume it would. In that instance, there were 3,700. They were only brought the prosecution on the basis of 9 and didn't do very well with those.
I don't recall very well the discussion last session, but there's just something about this bill that makes me uneasy.
I could refresh your memory. Council has read through the minutes of the last meeting. If it would help you, I could read the 4 or 5 points.
Yeah.
There were questions brought up in the committee about the broadness of quote, accessing, whether Oregon has a need for such a specific statute, whether other criminal statutes actually cover the area, impact on the private sector, and limitation to only, quote, fraud.
Sounds familiar.
And I think I remember you're asking
all those
the question that you've already asked tonight.
I'm sure the question I asked. Has anything changed?
having a faith that the common law...
The only thing that I know of that has changed is that we have more specific statutes on the books in other states. 11 states now.
Has any computer crime materialized in Oregon since the 81 session?
I'm sorry, Senator, I don't have the access to that information, if it, in fact, in terms of being able to document it. I'm told it exists. I cannot document it.
But you have no official notice of that or knowledge of that? In Oregon?
I have knowledge of a case under investigation, but I'm not at liberty to say anything more than that.
Mr. Chairman, one more question. The technology is progressing, is it not, in terms of security devices to prevent unauthorized access?
Yes, the literature is that is one area where there needs to be a lot of tightening up, and the example that Mr. Gaminani gives of the Indiana case is one where their security was very poor, and he suggests that this individual in the mental health division did them a service by, you know, making them sharpen up on that. He concludes his dissertation, however, with the suggestion that you're never going to make the security device foolproof. It's just one more clever person on top of another.
Okay, thank you very, very much. That will close the hearing on Senate Bill 149. And now we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 151. Chris Van Dyke, District Attorney Marion County.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Chris Van Dyke, Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here this evening on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association to offer testimony on Senate Bill 151, which is an amendment to provide amendments to ORS 165-540. This is a Oregon District Attorneys Association bill. I think it's important, initially, as a point of departure in my testimony, to explain to the committee precisely what the District Attorneys Association is proposing in terms of changes to the statutory provisions regarding interception of communications. More specifically, we are requesting that ORS 165-540 sub 5A be changed or altered to include not only those situations where an officer, an undercover agent, is involved in investigating crimes involving controlled substances, but to change the statute so that an officer or someone at the officer's direction, when they have reasonable cause to believe that a felony has been, is being, or is about to be committed, may intercept that communication by way of some electronic device, or probably a body bug. In discussing this, I think it's important to note, for the committee's benefit, that there should be an additional amendment, which was not an amendment changing the statute, which was not provided in the draft given to you. Under sub 5C, the line "to enforce laws relating to controlled substances" should be altered to make it consistent with the changes in 5A, since we're actually expanding the area to include all felonies. And we would submit written amendments to make the two provisions internally consistent. In discussing some of the reasons why we're offering this, I think it's just as important to discuss for the committee's benefit what this statute does not do. We've had, I guess we can consider, experience in discussing this in the House in regards to a House Bill 2389, which was a Sheriff's Association proposal asking that all communications be subject to interception, not just communications where an officer has a reasonable basis to believe a felony has been or is being committed.
You urged them to adopt this language in their bill, as I understand.
We did. We did. And I'll get to some of the rationale for that in a moment. What I think some of the opponents of the bill are going to suggest is that we are dealing with constitutional questions of a right to privacy. And I believe that is simply not the case when discussing problems involved in intercepting the communications where one party is aware of the communication being intercepted, in this case, an officer or an undercover agent. We're not dealing with rights to privacy for a couple of reasons. First, the U.S. Supreme Court has already spoken on this issue in U.S. versus Hoffa and indicated that this is not a violation of right to privacy. They termed it more a misplaced confidence. I think what we're dealing with instead...
Really, Hoffa's case, certainly was.
What we're dealing with, I think, more precisely...
The first case of misplaced confidence.
One of several.
The second was fatal.
I think what we're dealing with more precisely is a public policy issue of how far do we want law enforcement to go in secretly recording conversations. I would suggest to the committee that it is this public policy that is really at the heart of the issue here and not a constitutional question of invasion of privacy. There's really no distinction in terms of constitutional analysis between a situation where two people have a face-to-face communication, one of the people walks away from that communication and then relates to other people, a grand jury, law enforcement, whoever, the substance of the conversation. What you're doing is merely adding a mechanical device that records the conversation. In constitutional terms, there's really no distinction. In public policy terms, I think we really have to start dealing with the issues of whether or not society, the community in general, finds repugnant to just general sense of propriety of whether or not police officers should be recording conversations.
Senator Hendricks.
Well, I just, in reading the bill, though, couldn't you have a situation where someone is eavesdropping on someone who is, they're not directly communicating with? It says they could be an officer or someone under the direct supervision. I was looking at page 2.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it only where there's direct conversation with that person? The person would have the recording device on them.
The first sentence says the prohibition to paragraph C, subsection 1, mm-hmm. and that provision deals with conversations where one person is aware of the conversation being recorded. The language you're referring to refers to an officer or an informant who is working at the officer's direction. For example, undercover agent, an paid informant, that sort of individual who has a body mic on the person and is involved in that conversation with a suspect.
Well, would the informant necessarily know that they've been bugged, or?
Well, they would have to under this provision. One person would have to be aware of the fact that the conversation was being recorded.
Chris, the federal law enforcement officials can do this in circumstances other than drug enforcement, can't they?
Yes, and they do it with some regularity.
Because they did it in that all the ABSCAM stuff and that kind of thing.
Oregon law so far only provides that in situations involving enforcement investigation of controlled substance violations,
right,
that officers can use that.
Oh, this could be done to politicians too then?
Absolutely.
Oh.
And if there's a recording, it could serve to protect as well as as to indict a politician.
But it already, to the extent there's a privacy concern, it's already available if it happens to be a federal offense and a federal officer that's conducting it.
Correct. And there are many, many offenses, even in situations where the conduct violates federal law, that federal authorities simply are unwilling or unable to get involved. And we'd like to extend those available resources to the local level to enforce local statutes.
Well, with the very liberal entrapment laws we have, this about to commit a felony, I don't know what the witnesses are going to say that are against this, but aren't they going to say that this invites a fishing expedition, that you put a bug on and go talk to somebody you think might be a crook?
Well, they have a reasonable basis to believe that a felony is about to be committed. The reason that language is included is to cover the conspiracy or planning stages of an offense where there's been some discussion or planning that has not risen to the level of a criminal conspiracy. But the officer has articulable facts that indicate that these people are going to be talking about robbing a store, committing a burglary, kidnapping, whatever, any felony offense.
Well, is he going to have to put down an affidavit in advance before he uses the bug, so you'll be able to judge later what his reasonable grounds were at the time he decided to?
No, this is not a court-authorized sort of interception. This is a two-party conversation interception. I would like to point out to the committee that the potential penalties remain unchanged, and that there is still the possibility of fines and imprisonment for violations of the statute. some comment was made that it would be unlikely the law enforcement officials would be prosecuted for violating this. That certainly hasn't been the case, at least of prosecution of law enforcement officials in Marion County. So if there's some history here of law enforcement officials being prosecuted for violation of statutes. I think the protections are built into the statute. I don't believe we're dealing with a constitutional issue, as I indicated. There has been, in previous attempts, I think, some discussion of the privacy rights violation, and I really would like to discuss that a little more because I think it's an important feature of the statute, that there is no real distinction between recording a conversation between two people from the situation where one person decides to divulge the contents of that conversation by simply walking away and telling someone else. We have no privacy interest, really, in the communications we have with other people. We certainly have some expectation very often. We place confidence in our communications. But the reality is that the contents of our communications, if they involve criminal allegations, can be divulged under subpoena power. A person can be required under a threat of contempt of court to divulge communications the two people have with one another. So there really is no constitutional...